This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Record-breaking Harvey, followed by the largest hurricane ever seen in the Atlantic, with Hurricane Jose right behind. Add the West engulfed in fire, millions flooded out in Asia. Who can keep up in a destabilized climate? This week on Radio EcoShock, we start with critical news science from Italy about the incredible heat as climate ramps up. Then our regular guest scientist Paul Beckwith paints the big picture missing in the media. It's radio that tries hard in trying times. New science shows killer heat waves will sweep the world as the globe warms. Are you ready for 55 degrees C or 131 degrees Fahrenheit? Nobody is. Our guest is Simone Russo, a geophysicist working at the Joint Research Center of the European Commission, located in Ispra, Varese, Italy. Simone, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
You are the lead author in a new paper published in the journal Nature. The title is Humid Heat Waves at Different Warming Levels. You arrived at startling results, but first, Simone, what inspired your team of scientists to look into this question?
Yes, we wanted to compare heat wave magnitude across different regions with different climates. So before this study, we have developed heat wave indicators by using only temperature. However, with the previous indicators based only on temperature measures, we have seen that in some regions of the world, these indices were not able to capture important historical heat waves, such as the one in Chicago in 1995. Then we have understood that the problem in some region was the humidity. And then we decided to have a new indicator or to correct the previous indicator on heatwave magnitude by using both temperature and relative humidity.
Yes, as you say, most people realize a dry heat is easier to take than heat and humidity. But why is that true for the human body?
For a physiological stress, in general, relative humidity is relevant because it describes the ability to lose heat through evaporative cooling. In general, the effect of heat waves on humans is amplified by relative humidity. Then high temperatures are harder to bear in humid air than they are in dry air. And the combined effect of temperature and humidity is measured in our study by using heat index that, according with the U.S. National Weather Service, is based on what is also called apparent temperature. When this temperature is above 55 degrees, this kind of temperature is very dangerous, even for healthy people.
And when do you think these incredible apparent temperatures could happen?
It could happen starting from 2050, but as an extreme event, it could happen even in the coming decades, but of course it's a more rare event. But if the global mean temperature will increase, then of course the probability of occurrence of this apparent temperature will be more likely.
We had a scientist on Radio EcoShock a few years ago, Simone, who told us two more factors add to the death toll during heat waves. The first is whether it cools down at night, giving the body core a chance to reset. And the second is the number of days where the temperature and humidity remain high. Simone, did you discuss these sorts of things in your new paper in Nature as well?
Yes, what we wanted to look at in this study, was to measure the peak of heat waves as a heat index, the maximum heat stress for humans. So in this study, we didn't take into account the night temperature, but we have taken into account the consecutive hot and humid days. So we have taken into account just one aspect of these two that you have described before. And our index gives put into a single number this consecutive hot and humid days.
Do you think your apparent heat wave index could be used by weather forecasters in the media?
Yes, of course it can be used, but it is difficult to forecast heat waves up to date. In general, it is very difficult to make seasonal forecasting. However, the advantage of this index is that it puts a lot of weather information into a single number, like consecutive hot days and high humidity days. And the same score can be used across regions with different climate.
So where are the regions where high heat and humidity are most likely to appear together?
Yeah, according with our results and also with other recent studies, there are high heat combined with high humidity are most likely to appear in the southern eastern U.S., in the eastern China, India, and Malaysia. However, we have investigated at global region, we have seen that there are regions like the eastern U.S., like, for example, all the Middle East in the U.S., like Chicago, where you have hot day, but not very hot, finally, like a temperature of 38 degrees, that are combined with an humidity that reaches, in summer, 80%. Whereas in India, you don't have very high humidity. You have in summer a humidity around 40-50%, but this kind of humidity is enough to amplify the very extreme temperature that reach like 45-46 degrees regularly.
I've also seen that there can be similar problems even in the Middle East, in Dubai or along the Gulf Coast, because occasionally they get very high humidity there, and of course they get record high heat that we've seen. You know, there are some heat waves that marry humidity to create mass fatalities and others do not. Simone, what were the conditions in Europe in 2003 when up to 70,000 people died?
Yeah, this is a famous heat wave, in particular in Europe. We have in some way shown that the heat wave in Europe are dry heat waves. So in summer, we don't have a combination of hot and high humidity. The summer heat wave of 2003 was a dry heat wave. The impact of this heat wave was very high for the persistence of hot consecutive day. So the level of humidity was low, but many people die because the what we call in climatology dry bulb temperature, so the temperature that we measure with a normal thermometer, reached a value that was around 46 degrees in city like Cordoba in southern Spain.
And we are just learning more and more about blocking patterns where the weather stalls over the region for a long time. What is a blocking, and do we know why it happens?
Yeah, in general, blocking is defined as a large-scale pattern in the atmospheric pressure field that is nearly stationary and is effectively blocking already directly migratory cyclones. So it's related to pressure, and regularly a heat wave occurs when we have a block in specific regions.
And you described the heat wave in Europe in 2003, but there was another one, the China heat wave phenomenon, in that same year. Could you tell us about the heat wave in China in 2003? What happened there?
Yeah, we have described this heat wave in Shanghai, in particular in 2003, and it was the hottest summer in over 50 years. The heat wave, the hottest day of the heat wave occurred in July 25, and the maximum temperature was 39 degrees. But the combination of temperature and humidity has amplified the apparent temperature level that was recorded equal to 48 degrees. And the level of mortality was very high during this heat wave. And in this region, this kind of heat wave are very likely. In fact, after 10 years in 2013, there was another heat wave, humid heat wave in the same regions that is documented in many studies.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Simone Russo, a scientist with the European Joint Commission in Italy. Simone, suppose governments in the Paris Accord actually meet their goals and we miraculously only warm up 2 degrees global mean temperature. What does your paper predict could happen?
Yeah, what we did in our paper, since we are using this magnitude indicator for heat wave that can compare the magnitude of heat wave across different regions, we have used as reference one of the most important heat wave occurred in the past, the Russian heat wave of the 2010. And we have seen that a 2 degree warming, so under the Paris Agreement, we can have such kind of heat wave due to the effect of humidity in some region of the world, like the eastern US, the eastern China, and India. And the probability of occurrence of this heat wave, of course, is not very high if we respect the Paris Agreement. We have estimated the probability in this region around 10-20%. It means that it's once every 20 years. This kind of heat wave are unlikely to occur in all the other regions where the humidity doesn't play an important role under 2 degree warming.
But I have to say, almost every scientist I've interviewed thinks we will go well beyond 2 degrees C warming, if not in this century, more certainly in the next. Simone Russo, what happens if we force the climate into a warming of, say, 4 degrees C?
Yeah, I would say from heat wave point of view is a disaster because it seems in particular that in this region where humidity is important during summer, where in the region where the level of humidity is very high during hot temperature, we can have a Russian heat wave for the effect of temperature and humidity occurring every 2 years. And the peak of this heat wave, so the maximum heat index measured during this heat wave, could be every 2 years greater than 55 degrees due to the combination of high humidity and temperature. So if we will not respect the Paris Agreement, the level of mortality due to humid heat wave in a specific region could strongly increase if we don't take some medication or something to protect people, at least during summer.
Well, if we have heat waves over 55 degrees C and every 2 years, that's going to be a terrible world to leave to our grandchildren or to our children. So I'm hoping we can keep to the Paris Accord at least. But looking forward, it sounds possible then that by the end of the century, possible that just going outside could be dangerous during summer in some parts of the world, but there's always going to be a need for outside workers. How can we plan or cope with the coming heat?
Of course, going outside could be very dangerous. What we can do, it's very, very difficult. In my opinion, the best would be to respect the environment and to reduce the greenhouse gases emission and to respect the Paris Agreement. But if we will have this kind of temperature peak, the best is not to go out and maybe to have some way to protect from the extreme heat, and in particularly having some air conditioning. But this will be in contrast with the reducing of the CO2 emission. So it's difficult to say what to do if we will get 4 degrees. I think the best, we have the last chance now, and we should try to not to go over 2 degree warming.
You know, an Australian scientist told us there are more heat deaths in Australia than from automobile accidents, and that's already, yet coroners often don't record heat as the cause of death. Do you think heat deaths are underestimated, and if so, how could we improve?
There could be an underestimation. In our study, we have used 9 climate models, and we have used temperature and relative humidity. Our relative humidity could be even underestimated by the model because we have used the minimum relative humidity of the day. And however, what I can say in our study, all the models seems to predict the same result. All the 9 models seems to be in agreement in terms of probability of occurrence of extreme heat waves.
Well, frankly, your new research is frightening for us and yet not completely unexpected for those who follow developing climate change. Are there limitations to your work or possible bright spots which might modify our sense of alarm?
Yes, the prediction just given by solving some equation and by some deterministic equation. So I think we have sufficient information to say that the prediction are robust. However, what we do is just to estimate the error in this model prediction. So we have a sort of error around the signal. And even the most optimistic models predict a very bad scenario talking about heat waves.
Where do you think science should go now? How can we further our understanding of heat impacts as the climate changes?
We should look at the impact of these extreme events and how we can adapt and mitigate to climate change. In my opinion, we should also have a clear risk map of the region that will be more vulnerable to climate extremes. We should also continue to study heat-related mortality of the present period in order to better understand what is likely to happen in the near future. From a technical perspective, looking at the model, but I think models are moving in this direction, we should improve the spatial resolution of the models because this will give us the possibility to predict in specific location. In our study, we have used large-scale models that predict heat waves in an area with a spatial resolution of around 200 kilometers.
Simone Russo, please tell us about the Institute for Environmental Protection and Research. Where are you located? Who funds the work that you do, and how big is the facility where you are?
The work has been financed by the European Commission Joint Research Center. This is a center of the European Commission that investigates on different environmental topics, but also one of the topics is finance and agriculture and economics. The researchers working here are around 1,000. The institute is located in the northern Italy, in a very nice place in Lago Maggiore, where there is good food and normally good weather, but in summer there are heat wave combined with high humidity because we are close to the lake. So even 35 degrees of temperature here.
I've seen pictures of the lake. It's a gorgeous location.
Yes.
Very beautiful. Is there anything about your new study, Simone, that I've missed? Is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners?
The main message was just that the effect of humidity will amplify the temperature signal in the future under climate change.
Well, and for me, what I got from your paper too was that the temperatures could go much higher than we've been used to or even that we really expected. When we talk about over 55 degrees C, that's really very hot.
I think, yes. And what I say is just the last maybe point that could be important. We are looking at a large spatial resolution, and this summer, this does not give us the possibility to look in specific local climate. For example, this year, this summer in Italy, in Emilia-Romagna, where the tagliatelle were invented, there was a very high temperature combined with humidity, and the temperature already reached like 51 apparent temperature degrees. So it was very high already.
Yeah, I didn't know it got that hot in Italy. I know there have been fires. I know that crops have been affected in both Italy and Spain. So there are almost indications that parts of the northern Mediterranean will become more like North Africa over time if climate change is allowed to proceed.
Yeah, I think this is really what is happening, but it's not demonstrated only in our study, but in many other studies, that desertification is affecting a larger area than in the past.
We've been speaking with Italian geophysicist Simone Russo. He's with the European Commission's Joint Research Center in Ispra Varese, Italy. Simone, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you, Alex. It was very interesting to talk to you, and thank you to everyone for listening.
You can find this new paper, Humid Heat Waves at Different Warming Levels, as published in the journal Nature, August 7th, 2017. I'll put links to the paper and the topics we've discussed in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
A couple of days before Irma arrived in the U.S., I called our regular EcoShock correspondent, scientist Paul Beckwith at the University of Ottawa. Paul already posted YouTube videos about Harvey and Irma, each getting tens of thousands of views, and this is our conversation. Paul, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's good to be talking.
It does feel like apocalypse has already arrived on planet Earth. What do we know about Irma, even before that hurricane's final course is determined?
Yes. I mean, Irma is setting all kinds of records for hurricanes in the Atlantic Basin. The ocean water is so warm, and it's not just sea surface temperature. It's warm as you go down into the depths of the water. So Irma has been, you know, feeding off that warm water and intensifying and having direct hits on some of the Caribbean islands. I mean, the only thing I could see that would reduce the strength is if there's possibly some shear winds, which can clip off a bit of the top, but they're minimal right now. And, you know, there's always a chance it could be steered away. And if it goes over Cuba, there's mountainous regions in southern Cuba, and that could clip off some of the intensity. But the water temperatures around Florida are pushing 31 degrees Celsius, and anything over 26 and a half, and you get intensification of these type of storms. So, you know, Irma's very large diameter storm. The winds have been 180 miles an hour for a record length of time, I think for over 24 hours, which sets a new record. And when you think about it, an EF4 tornado has winds in the range 166 to 200 miles per hour. So, you know, at 180, 185, Irma is well within that category. With a tornado, you're talking about those winds over a diameter of, you know, maybe a, you know, kilometer or a mile wide tornado. I think those winds for Irma, somebody was claiming that that was over about 50 miles before the wind dropped off. So it's like a 50-mile EF4 tornado, which is unfathomable to comprehend, really.
You know, I can remember about 10 years ago, Kerry Emanuel was saying with climate change, we would get more hurricanes. And then he kind of retracted that. We've always had hurricanes, but there were more hit Florida in the 1990s and recently. So it seems to me, Paul, maybe the climate connection is not necessarily that we will get more of these big storms, but that when they do come, they will be more powerful.
Yes. I mean, this is a very, very active area of research, the effect of, I mean, definitely the guiding of these storms is different with climate change. Definitely the nature of these storms, like what happens to them when they run ashore, can be different. You know, Sandy was very unusual. It did a left turn and hit New York because it couldn't go do its regular right turn. It couldn't go north because of the configuration of the jet streams. So Hurricane Harvey, of course, came ashore, and it was only moving at a few kilometers an hour. Normally, these things fly over a region at, you know, 20 kilometers an hour or something and clear out, and, you know, they weaken as soon as they go over land. But, of course, with Harvey, it dumped so much water over the land that water was actually sustaining the strength of the hurricane over land, and it was also connected to the ocean. So it was basically acting as a big fire hose, if you like, just pumping, you know, water that had evaporated and formed clouds and precipitated, you know, over Texas. So it was a connection from the ocean to the land, essentially, you know, and dumped, what, I don't know, 27 trillion gallons or some absurd number, right? It's unfathomable number of water, over 50 inches in some places. So, you know, the jet streams with Irma, you know, in the present jet stream configuration, I would expect that it would not linger around.
The thing that really irritates me, Paul, is I hear TV news anchors and weather people will sometimes show the jet stream, and they will even mention that there are these blocking patterns that can keep these storms lingering right over a certain point of land, but they never point out the connection to the Arctic. And you've talked about that on Radio EcoShock before, but would you just briefly explain again the mechanism where changes in the Arctic can influence big storms like this?
Yeah, so the key difference is now to, you know, we've always had big storms like this, but they're behaving differently now because the guiding mechanism of these storms is the jet streams, and the jet streams have slowed down and become much wavier, so the ridges are much higher, in fact extending as high as the Arctic in some cases, and much lower and extending right down and even connecting with jet streams and crossing into the southern hemisphere. You know, these are observations. So because the Arctic is getting a lot darker, right, we're losing the sea ice. There's less and less sea ice coverage over the ocean. So the dark ocean underneath, there's more of that exposed with less sea ice. And there's also less snow cover over the dark permafrost and tundra covering, you know, on the land surfaces in the Arctic. So the Arctic is getting a lot darker. It's absorbing a lot more sunlight and heating up. So because the Arctic's heating up a lot more than relative to other parts of the planet, such as the equator, the temperature difference or gradient to the equator is reduced, and that temperature gradient sets up the jet streams. So it's lower, so the jet streams are slower and wavier and getting stuck into position. So the jet streams were configured for Harvey, I call it Superstorm Harvey. They were over land, and they were not there. They would normally be lower, and so a hurricane like Harvey would go ashore and be caught by the jet streams and pulled quickly inland elsewhere, and it would deposit. So the rain would be spread over much larger areas because it would be moving over the land at a decent clip. But because the jet streams were further north, Harvey just stalled out and just, you know, did a few loops and just sat in one position for days on end. So torrential rains for 4 or 5 days, and, you know, we know what happened. Sandy, like I said, turned left because of the jet stream configuration. The jet stream configuration now is there's a huge trough over Western Canada and the U.S., so that's very hot and dry air, and that's one of the main reasons there's all of these fires in those regions. And the trough of the jet stream is north of Florida. There's some air being dragged across Florida, which will hopefully guide the latest hurricane away so it won't linger, you know, if it does in fact hit Florida.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock with my guest, climate scientist Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa. I really liked your two videos on Hurricane Harvey. You explained exactly how to use mapping information previously only available to big institutes and governments. At websites like earth.nullschool.net, we can see what's really happening on planet Earth in real time. That's amazing. I know well-known climate bloggers like Robert Scribler use these tools a lot. It seems you're trying to arm citizen scientists. Is that part of your plan?
Yes, I think, when people can actually, learn a little bit about these websites that are very, very simple to use, you just have to do a bit of navigation around and sort of know a little bit about some of the parameters that you can look for. So with Earth Null School in particular, in fact, I've got my iPhone in front of me. So if you just Google Earth Null School and, you see a globe and there's an icon Earth in the bottom left corner. If you just click on that, you can see all the menus. And if you want to see the jet streams, you select the pressure level of 250 millibar and you can see the configuration of the jet streams. And if you want to look at what you can see, so the mode is air, the height is 250, the overlay is wind, and you can see you can move around on the map, navigate on the map just by dragging if you're on an iPhone, and you can see a very strong ridge over Western North America, and then the strong trough coming down near Florida, and you can see basically Irma and where Irma is and get parameters on Irma. You can get information on the ocean temperatures. On if you go to mode particulates and select something like PM 2.5, which is a small particles, less than 2.5 micron, they're given off by forest fires. So you can actually identify the locations of all of the fires that are going on and see where the smoke is going, where the particles are going, et cetera, things like that. So these sites, I try to educate people as much as I can so that they can use some of these tools and show them to their friends, et cetera. Because, seeing it with your eyes is, quite different from just being told about it.
And you're essentially teaching a rolling climate science course to tens and thousands of people through YouTube. Is that partly because you, Paul, are frustrated with the slow pace of communication by other scientists?
Yeah, I mean, it's very frustrating. We're seeing our planet deteriorate in front of our very eyes, at very, very rapid paces. And, we just don't seem to be heading in the right direction in terms of making progress to address the problem. So the more people that can learn, some of these tools and figure out some of these things can then, spread them around. And education of people is probably one of the best ways to get action on addressing climate change. So I try to educate the public on these things as much as I can. This is what I've been doing for many years with my website, paulbeckwith.net, and also my YouTube videos, usually a couple a week. And I just rely on donations to do all of this work. Otherwise, it's on my own time and own expense. So, I'm very concerned about the changes that are happening on our planet and the very slow pace in dealing with it. The governments talk about carbon prices and carbon fees, cap and trade, et cetera, out of one side of their mouth, and then out of the other side of their mouth, actually, which they don't actually talk about, is the, $5 trillion of subsidies to fossil fuel companies, which is, a negative fee on carbon or a negative tax, if you like. It's encouraging fossil fuel companies to produce more oil, more gas, et cetera. There's a lot of these discontinuities in society and in what's happening. People are saying one thing and then, follow the money. I mean, that's what I always say, follow the money. As long as there's $5 trillion subsidizing fossil fuel companies, then this problem is going to get worse and worse. Climate change is going to get worse and worse.
And meanwhile, strange records are popping up all over. The biggest rain dump in U.S. history with Harvey, the largest fire in Los Angeles history, maybe one of the biggest hurricanes crossing the Atlantic, as you say, with Irma. Extreme rains all over the world. I won't go into a long list of those. When I interviewed climate scientists 10 years ago, all this was expected by 2100, maybe 2040 at the earliest. Why is climate disruption coming so much sooner than expected?
The main reason is, for some reason, the scientific community didn't—well, there's an over-reliance on computer models, and I guess computer models, you know, that you can only put in computer models what you understand about the system, and they completely underestimated the regional changes that would be occurring with climate change. So, you know, really the huge warming, you know, rates of warming in the Arctic, the very, very rapid declines of sea ice and snow cover far exceeded what anything modeled showed. So those declines have changed the heat balance on the planet. So, you know, we're seeing all of these things happening and shifting as a result of that. So that's the biggest thing that was overlooked. And it's become extremely clear in the last few years that's the reason why things are changing so fast.
And climate sensitivity. We had an interview about a year ago with another scientist who was saying that was just misunderestimated how sensitive this place is. And I think, too, Paul, the way things interact, you know, science can be siloed and somebody studies one area and somebody studies another. But what we didn't realize were the way these feedbacks were going to work.
Yes, I mean the feedbacks in the system are enormous, and like, you know, the biggest one in the Arctic, of course, is that, you know, as you lose sea ice and snow cover because of the warming, then it gets darker, so there's more sunlight absorbed, so there's more heating, so then you lose more snow cover and sea ice, and the cycle repeats until you have no sea ice. And when you have no sea ice and when you have less and less ice to melt, then the heat, as long as there's ice there, the heat goes into melting that ice. So you have the latent heat effects. But as soon as there's no ice, then that heat just goes into heating the water. And the amount of energy to melt a kilogram of ice is sufficient to raise a kilogram of water 80 degrees Celsius. So there's a huge, as long as there's ice in the Arctic, it keeps it cooler. You know, they lose that ice and the temperature rockets upward. So this latent heat feedback is huge. As you have less sea ice, there's more and more wave action, more and more erosion of coastlines, more mixing of the warmer water underneath in the Arctic with the colder water on the top. You know, and there's all kinds of different things that are happening, which haven't been captured well in the models. So I've been saying for quite a while that we need to declare a global climate change emergency on this planet and, you know, work in unison to be very serious at addressing this problem, at slashing fossil fuel emissions, working out carbon dioxide removal methods to lower CO2 levels, and really seriously look at cooling the Arctic. If we lose all the sea ice, then the Greenland melt rates will skyrocket, and we also risk methane emissions coming up from the permafrost and also from the seafloor sediments, and then those will rocket our temperature much higher. I mean, look at what's happening, you know, this summer with fire and floods, everything we've been talking about, you know, and our global average temperature is only about a degree or 1.2 degrees above pre-industrial. So to talk seriously about 2 degrees being safe or, you know, 3 or 4 degrees being survivable, I mean, the IPCC goes through great lengths and has all these scenarios where they talk about 3 and 4 degrees increases. You know, talk to any scientist and they'll say a 4-degree increase over a short period of time on the Earth and we can't grow food anymore, we can't get water, and, you know, countries just collapse, right? I mean, this is extremely serious stuff, and all of the, you know, misinformation and fake news and deniers of it, like, this is absurd. Like, it's really hard to come to grips with the reality of today's situation, you know, versus the reality of how rapidly and seriously the climate is changing and the huge negative impacts it's having on people around the planet already. You know, it's really hard to jive these things.
This is Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock with my guest, climate scientist Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa. His website is paulbeckwith.net. Got to totally agree with you. I think we are in a climate emergency. I've just spoken with Simone Russo. He's with the European Joint Commission Study Group in Italy. And his paper comes out saying that by 2100, if we go 4 degrees of warming, which I think is quite probable, every 2 years, many parts of the Earth will see heat waves of 55 degrees C or 131 degrees Fahrenheit for days on end, and that's kind of killer heat. So if you want to talk about extreme emergencies, that science has got to be another great big warning flag.
Yeah, I mean, there's limits to, you know, there's a 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb temperature, and your body is unable to sweat and get rid of heat, you know, so you can't even survive at that type of condition. So, you know, when you up the temperature above 35, and, you know, you can plot what humidity would be required where you can no longer sweat. And, you know, because it's not 100% humidity, as you raise the temperature, it would be less where you can't dissipate heat. So, you know, we're talking about areas of Earth being uninhabitable. So, yes, I mean, all of these things are happening. And also, you know, you need to tie this in, you know, how resilient is our global economic systems, is our civilization? I mean, we just had an event that is estimated to cost $200 billion, which is Superstorm Harvey, the effects on Houston, fourth largest city in the U.S., and we have Irma heading to, you know, how many of these, it takes years to recover from this, and if these things are happening more frequently than years, then you don't recover, and the system, you know, the expenses build up, and the system just can't withstand that sort of thing.
I totally agree with you, Paul. You know, when I interviewed Bob Henson, he's a meteorologist with the Weather Underground. He's very climate aware. He's written a book about it. And I talked to him about the Houston flooding, and I wondered out loud if extreme rainfall events and the huge costs, as you talk about, of trying to recover so-called normal life, eventually that will eat away at the model of megacities around the world. And I just don't know if our current system is sustainable in the face of rapid climate change.
Not the way we're heading. It doesn't appear to be.
And then we have the crash of coastal real estate due to rising seas. I think this, if Irma hits Florida hard, then we'll see it again. This whole real estate market is based on sky-high values along the ocean. Remember, the 2008 crash happened because of housing values falling, and major cities are going to have to give up due to encroaching oceans from rising seas. This could really destabilize the economy.
Yeah, I mean, like the $200 billion or $190 billion that we're talking about, you know, that's a significant chunk of GDP, right? So I think the U.S. projection was to grow 0.8% GDP, you know, in the, you know, the rest of this year, and that's being clipped. You know, take off one for Houston, 1%. You know, take off more for what happens in Florida if it's hit, which it appears that it will be. And, you know, we're talking about, like, there's a disconnect. I mean, look at stock markets right now. They're at record high levels. Like, they haven't even budged, really, you know, with what's going on with the fires, with the climate. They tend to ignore it. I mean, GDP, whenever there's a huge natural disaster, it's not reflected in GDP because all of the money to rebuild, you know, it stimulates GDP. GDP goes up. It looks like everything's hunky-dory, right? I you know, it's hard to fathom how we're doing everything so wrong. You know, economists and financial institutions all follow and track, you know, one number, GDP, which misleads people as far as natural disasters go.
Yeah, you're stimulating me to another idea here. I mean, Great Britain won the First World War at great cost, and then after the Second World War, they were pretty well financially broken and without their former empire. And I wonder if the same thing could happen to the United States as it appoints climate deniers to oversee science and energy. These climate wars, if you want to call them that, will include floods, fires, droughts, unstable food prices. That could eventually lead to financial crashes, maybe serious system breakdown. Maybe America will lose its global military bases and leadership. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this is exactly what will happen on the path that we're taking, the path that the U.S. is taking right now. You know, the denying of reality of what's happening, you know, and blaming it on other things is a huge issue. You know, add to that some of the other huge stresses to the capitalist system, for example, the inequality, you know, the one percenters versus the rest of people. You know, add AI and technology that reduces jobs, right? So, you know, as there's more and more jobs removed from those sort of things, and, you know, talking about driverless cars, World Bank talking about 500,000 jobs being gone even by 2020, you know, as these things happen, the people that own the robots get even more and more wealthy, and the rest of the people get less and less, and the equality gets enormous. This is why there's talk about minimum guaranteed income in some countries for people, and this is, you know, all of these sort of things are stressing the system. And, you know, to not recognize the stresses in the system, it's like, for example, you know, the government in Florida, you know, the state government, that you can't mention climate change if you work for the state government in Florida, because in order for all these vacation homes to be built and for money to go into the economy and real estate, that's all threatened by sea level rise. It's, you know, I mean, they thought they had a lot of time, you know, with sea level rise, that things would sort of, you know, work themselves out, or maybe there'd be climate action or whatever. So, but, you know, they're just trying to prop up a failing system. I mean, if this storm, you know, wreaks tremendous damage on, you know, Florida, which it appears that it will do, then, you know, is this going to be enough to get at least people acknowledging climate change and, you know, saying it's an emergency situation, we have to act? I don't know. I mean, that remains to be seen, right? But
I'm doubtful. I think that as climate activists that I know have been thinking, well, once there's enough of a hurt, people will change and get with a sudden climate program. Maybe that'll happen in 10 or 20 years, but I'm not seeing the signs of it. It seems almost the opposite. People go in reverse and go into harder denial and long even more for the life that they had in the 60s and the 70s.
I know. I mean, we have this problem, and the job losses are being blamed on immigrants, right? So then it creates all the, you know, immigrant hate and tensions and, you know, policies to, you've been following the U.S. With the, you know, the kids of immigrants. I mean, immigrants that went to the U.S., their kids will lose their jobs and be kicked out of the country. You know, they've been here for years, and who's going to do those jobs?
Machines.
Right. So this is that idea. And yeah, it's what you said can happen if the real reasons for, you know, the root causes of these disruptions are not understood widespread in the public and by leaders and stuff, then the problems are just ignored and get worse and worse, and other reasons are invoked for things, and you never get to addressing the root cause of the problem.
There's a few positive signs, though. I noticed that the head of China is castigating the United States for not getting into climate action and calling for more climate action. And now we have a couple of European countries, including Great Britain, have at least announced an end date for vehicles burning gas or diesel fuel. But of course, that promised time is at least two decades away. There are a few signs that things are changing. There's more solar power coming on stream. It just seems like it's too slow.
Yes, it's much too slow. And you know, this is, if an emergency is declared and it's clearly explained, you know, why it's necessary to have an emergency basis, you know, it's like during the Cold War or during World War II, you know, those examples are often given, then people realize that there's problems and act towards solving the problems. So, I mean, we spend a fortune on military budgets, you know, if the biggest threat is all of these climate disasters ramping up in frequency, severity, duration, economic costs, threatening to put us in a state where we can't recover. You know, these massive storms that take years to recover from, if they're happening so frequently, we can't recover from them, right? Then think of all of the engineers and scientists that, you know, get paid from military budget dollars to, you know, build more sophisticated weapons, et cetera, to fight wars. Think of all that technical know-how going into carbon dioxide removal techniques, solar radiation management techniques, innovations in renewable energies and battery technology. I mean, we could greatly accelerate our push to doing all of these things to address climate change if the money is directed in the right places. But, you know, we don't have forever. I mean, many people are saying it's too late. You know, I don't know if it's too late or not, but I don't think that really, you know, we have to try, you know, whether or not it's too late. I don't think we've even tried to do anything really. Like I say, you know, we talk about carbon taxes and cutting fossil fuel emissions and all of these things, and yet we still subsidize, we governments around the world subsidize fossil fuels to, you know, $5 trillion is a number. I mean, just, you know, just Google and have a look. I mean, the number is usually thrown out. You know, the number that you usually hear is much lower than that, but I think that's probably one of the most realistic numbers. So, you know, and until that changes, I mean, even, you know, even in Canada, you know, okay, we're bringing in a carbon tax, but, you know, the subsidies for fossil fuels are enormous and they're never talked about, so they dwarf any carbon tax.
And the same government approves more pipelines to get the tar sands out.
Exactly.
It's a double-handed deal. They're still pushing the idea that Canada will be a fossil fuel energy power. As we say, we're going to do lots about climate change. That's baloney.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, how much pain has to occur? You know, do we need to lose a Canadian city? You know, as the ocean warms, as the jet streams shift and stuff, these storms can come much further north, right? And
well, we already had Calgary flooded out and the oil industry just carried on.
Yeah, I mean, imagine the type of rainfall in Calgary over the over Fort McMurray, right? You know, the tailings ponds would fill up, all that water would go into the Athabasca River, and that would run up into the Arctic. And you know, there's lots of scenarios that are becoming much more feasible. And, you know, they're horrifying. We wouldn't have thought of them before.
Now, as a person who teaches university classes, you hand out assignments, I'm sure. What assignment would you hand out to Radio EcoShock listeners?
I think the best thing would be to, you know, really try to, first of all, you know, get more familiar with things like Earth Null School and Climate Reanalyzer, and, you know, really try to get information out to other people, you know, friends that you know, colleagues at work, people like that, you know, your local politicians. Just try to figure out, you know, how to use your skills to educate the public on how serious climate change has become. You know, make those links that the media is not making, and you know, really try to figure out what could you do so that more and more people are aware of how risky climate change is, and that we have to get governments to declare a global climate change emergency and to stop subsidizing fossil fuels. You know, I don't have the answers to that. And ironically, you know, unfortunately, I mean, I manage to get at least a course to teach each term in the fall and winter terms, but enrollment has dropped in the department I'm in. So it's mostly, the courses are mostly being taught by full professors. You know, and I teach as a sessional or part-time professor, so I'm not teaching any courses this term or next term. This is why I made the plug earlier for donations on my website, so I can keep doing these videos.
Unbelievable. You should have hundreds of people flocking to your classes. I would come if I lived in Ottawa, so, oh, this is so strange. We should be seeing, you know, a university devoted to teaching climate change.
Yeah, I mean, there are universities that are setting up departments and things, but there's nothing in Ottawa, University of Ottawa or Carleton. Yeah, again, the university is a specialized place, right? It's full of specialists, and, you know, even the specialists just don't connect the dots of all the different components, and therefore, you know, they don't understand how risky and serious climate change is the bottom line. They really don't. There's great people online that you can follow and things that are starting to connect all of the dots and stuff. And there's more in the print, in the main press. There's lots of blogs and stuff, but it's not, you know, like there's a group called the Canadian Association of Geographers, CAG. You know, and I sent an email a few months ago saying, you know, what would it take to declare a climate change emergency? You know, can CAG, which is basically a, you know, connection, I mean, they have it's an NGO, I guess, and they have email list groups and stuff. And, you know, there's some academics that come on and say, well, you know, it would require this. They're a very interesting question. And, you know, there are a bunch, you know, maybe half a dozen, 10 people responding to that email. And, you know, the president came on and, you know, had some stuff. Nothing's done. Like, there's no email saying we're in a climate change emergency. There's no stipulation. Hey, we've lost half the coral reefs. Do we have to lose all of them in order to declare it? Do we have to lose another city, you know, as I call it, in the climate casino to do it? I don't know. I mean, for years I've thought that the complete loss of sea ice in the Arctic might do it, right? And, you know, maybe that'll happen by 2020 or earlier. But if we're going to lose major cities getting flooded out, and, you know, the damages from climate change, from extreme weather events, are ramping up extremely rapidly. So maybe that would be the, you know, that would eventually do it, or maybe not. I don't know. I mean, people have to understand the root causes of these extreme weather events ramping up in order to, and that message isn't really getting out there. If you look at all the coverage in the U.S., on Harvey, you know, there's very little talk of climate connection.
Well, not to mention there's, I think, 46 million people out of their homes in India and Asia right now due to flooding over there with sort of a super monsoon cycle. There's so much we could talk about. We're going to have to wrap it up there. Our guest and guide is Paul Beckwith. He's got two master's degrees and a huge YouTube following us. Really, that's kind of his climate class right now. You can search out his name on YouTube, Paul Beckwith, or go to paulbeckwith.net. I check it regularly, probably every second day. You can also check my show blog at ecoshock.org for links to Paul's work, this conversation, and his previous appearances on Radio EcoShock, which have been very popular. People are still downloading them. As always, thank you so much, Paul, for joining us, and please never give up this fight.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
I'm Alex Smith. For Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Join me next week for more breaking climate science explained by the scientists themselves, plus a well-known alternative voice with a better way out. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. I've got some guests coming up with solutions I know are better than this from AfroZen.
The reason I call it die-off, the is because I see a really horrible future coming. It's not one that I want.
It was good while.